You know, it occurred to me as this Moody Blues piece was wafting by that these super beings move between the celestial bodies in craft. And I'm wondering, they cannot be as great can be, if they cannot simply travel by thinking. Because the blues just told you, thinking is the best way to travel. So think for a couple of minutes and then think yourself right back and we'll go on through this hour with tonight's guest, Gerald Clark. And just a reminder of his book, you should have it in your library, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators and Slavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. And perhaps Gerald can give us some insights as to what to expect. We covered the scientific aspect of it, at least a little tiny drop of it, and the all manner of perversion that can be visited upon us from the technology arena. I wonder if technology could actually cut the connection between our souls and our Creator. And come to think of it, what is the soul? We'll get into that with Mr. Clark when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, we were talking a little bit earlier about supercharging our consciousness with the introduction of, I guess, the very thing that was written about in Exodus 32:20 about burning the golden calf in the fire, grind it into powder, scatter it on the water, and make the Israelites drink it. I mean, what happened then?
Wow. Well, I actually went back and reread that after I read Lawrence Gardner's book and realized that on Mount Sinai, the Hathor's temple, they were smelting gold to ingest as conical cakes to prolong their lives and increase their consciousness and whatever else the side effects were. So it's really interesting now that you know that. And then go back to the Moses story in Exodus 32:20, as you stated, and I quote, "And he took the calf the people had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to a powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it." Sounds to me like he learned something up at Hathor's temple about what starfire gold does to consciousness, and he was tired of his rabble-rousers going on down there, decided to just change their consciousness for him. Looks like that to me. Done it to you, John?
Yes, it sounds like a pretty strong case could be made for it. Now, let me ask you this. Why is it called starfire gold?
Oh, well, there were a bunch of names for this philosopher's stone. They had all kinds of different names for it.
I gotcha.
Why the term star was in there, I've heard it called white powder gold and starfire gold, and they're all different names for it. And there are different ways to make it, too, by the way. The one I alluded to was the old smelting method, which I guess depending on the cost of antimony and how much temperature you got to produce to do this, and gold isn't that hard to melt, but I got to look at the temperature melting point for antimony. As an engineer, I probably have that table laying around here somewhere. Anyway, where was I? Antimony. So the other method was to do it alchemically, and I referred to this in this Aqua Regia solution, and this is where David Hudson comes into play. He was the guy that was mentioned who actually wrote a patent in Britain, and I have it sitting here right next to me. I've been studying it diligently, how to make monoatomic elements out of the transition metals, and including the platinum group, and there's six of them in there. So because of the ease of getting the diatom to bust apart, attaching it to a sodium ion, and then getting it to reconstitute readily. They do an alchemical method of making starfire gold now, and it's actually an amazing product, I have to say.
Go ahead. Okay, it'll keep.
Well, I have a couple of instances. I met somebody who'd been using it in Hawaii who was pondering the idea of longevity and its effects on longevity that had been touted. And the idea is, if you can produce enough telomerase in the body, figure out what the precursor is, whether it's food or transitional metals that are put into a solution like we're talking about, whatever it is, the precursor to telomerase, if you can produce it in the body, you will not age. In significant quantities such that the telomeres don't shorten. And when the DNA replicates, this is the end of the DNA, when it replicates, if all the material is replicated sufficiently each time without any degradation, you will not age. Okay, this is what the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to these three scientists in 2009 for finding. Well, the Anunnaki knew this way back when. Even at Exodus 32:20, they knew this. So somehow this solution of either annealed gold as a powder, or if you create it from this alchemical process, and the bottom line is getting to a monoatomic element that has these super properties, right? Well, one of the super properties seems to be affecting the pineal gland, causing it to open up, producing dimethyltryptamine in your brain. It really does that. That's where the bliss part comes in after 20 years of yoga, is that. Okay? And it also seems to do something quite mystical that we didn't really talk about, and that is to turn these primitive workers into what they termed, and I don't mean to be using a religious term, but they called it to the sons of gods. This idea of apotheosis by changing their energy body, just like they were doing in the mystery schools along the Nile. Well, they were being changed genetically as well. Something in their DNA was being turned on through this process that other people didn't have. And this somehow caused them to have much higher IQs and to be experiencing really amazing realities, longer lives and all kinds of things. So the idea of what was going on with the Starfire Gold to prolong their lives, I think we get that now. And I was going to tell you, I met somebody not long ago who's been a writer in this space, who's been using it for what he claims to be over 11 years. He's in his 80s now, and he is mystified by the effects of it, including gray hair turning back dark and skin tone changing and all kinds of things. So it's pretty profound, according to him. And I would tell you, as a user myself, it's hard to describe the extent to which it subtly affects your energy body state. It's highly effective.
The little gold flakes that sometimes are added to Japanese food, and the Goldwasser that the Germans put out. Was this sort of an attempt to get this going on, or was that just sort of a fanciful decoration for the food and drink?
I think there was probably some science behind it, and there's a lot of people that are playing. And I have to tell you, the science that I stumbled across in this space that I didn't expect. First, there's the Japanese scientist, Masaru Emoto, who was doing all kinds of experiments with energy affecting water, whether it's your thoughts or some other thing,
and
then look at the particles, so the idea of energy affecting water and water having some sort of capacitive memory for what the energy it's being exposed to seems to be real science. So there's a whole group of people I met recently that are in the mining business, including the head of the Western Mining Alliance up in near Lake Tahoe. And one of the byproducts of that whole industry is black sand, which is magnetite, which all of a sudden is in high demand because people want this to surround water with it to create a magnetic field around it, leave it exposed for a while, and they're doing various experiments with changing the state of water before they consume it. Including off-gassing it and doing all kinds of other things, and it's really quite interesting what's happening in that space relative to water and these transitional metals. So another thing I was hearing about was these colloidal silvers that have been going on for a while, where you can buy a device that has a little silver strip on it, and it probably runs an electric field through that causes electric ions of it to come off, and it goes into the water, and they sell this, and people just swear by it. and it probably has something to do with the interaction of these monoatomic elements in there that are affecting their energy body relative to the electromagnetic spectrum that's hitting all of us all the time. And the thing that we don't talk about is our relationship to gravity and how that affects your energy body. And I think that is a very, very significant force field that really needs a lot more attention. And in a book written by a guy named McCutcheon, he wrote a book called The Final Theory. And I've been all through academia. I've been all through the physics series. I've read everything by just about all the guys, including Feynman and everything Einstein had as well. And the idea that we understood gravity didn't understand gravity even to this day, it was a mystery to me. And not long ago, up at Caltech, they were doing laser interferometer tests to try to determine what the frequency or wavelength of gravity was by focusing on the black hole in the middle of our galaxy near Sagittarius A. And this was in 2007 or so, and they wrote about it in this book called The Future of Space-Time. It's interesting to me because I know Marshall Klarfeld went to Caltech, but so does my oldest boy, Matthew Clark. He's in his third year in engineering there at Caltech. And so he's bumping shoulders with, you know, people like Stephen Hawking and Kip Thorne, who was postulating this idea about what gravity is. And to make a long story short is we've been taught equations about what gravity is and told it's an accelerated force, and basically it's not true. It was a model of what it does to things, but it wasn't a model of what it really is. And in McCutcheon's book, in the very first chapter, he starts describing what gravity is. And when you read what force it truly is and how it affects humans, it's so important for us to pay attention to it, and we don't.
Are we being pulled down or are we being pushed down?
We're being pushed up. So I'll just give you a brief summary of it. I didn't talk about it much in my book. I didn't want to cause a firestorm over gravity, too. After all, already...
Oh, why not?
Already pulling the carpet out from underneath who Allah was and who Enlil was and all of them. You know, so anyway, well... It was very interesting, so I don't know if I should go there.
Well, it's okay, but I mean, no, please go there. Are we being pushed down onto the earth or pulled down? I mean, the song goes, "The wind beneath my wings."
Oh,
it's not the wind beneath your wings; it's the wind over the top of your wings.
I didn't want your readers to have too much science in one night, but let's do it. Okay, so in the model for gravity, we're told it's an accelerated force, 9.8 meters per second squared, or 32 feet per second squared. Okay. And
yes.
If it was truly an accelerated force, you drop something at altitude, it would accelerate and keep accelerating until it hit the ground. It doesn't. It reaches a terminal velocity. So our model of gravity is wrong, at least as an accelerated force. Okay? That's number one. So you start digging into what this number is as we model gravity real close to the Earth, and it turns out to be, when you correlate it with the fact that we're living in an expanding universe, and we can tell this through spectroscopy, and the Perkinsey shift, and a whole bunch of other ways, that all matter is expanding. We don't really know why. And it's expanding at the atomic expansion rate, according to McCutcheon.
Is that right?
What does that mean? Suppose everything around you is all matter is expanding. And I'll do a real simple analogy so you can get what that's like. First of all, if you're going up in an elevator, you're being pushed down, but you're actually going up. That creates the sensation of being pulled down, right? But you're actually being pushed up. Okay, so that's number one. There's an action and reaction that you sense. Simultaneously, let's imagine that there is an atomic expansion rate that happens to be real close to what the constant force of gravity is near the Earth.
All right.
Which we know that's true, by the way. We've just been lied to. Anyway, so imagine the Earth is a big beach ball, and you're the little tiny marble sitting on the beach ball. And the big beach ball is expanding, and you're expanding at the same rate, right? That's what we're saying. You with me?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, let's not make the little ball a marble. Let's make it a rubber ball as well, a volleyball. Okay? Little tiny ball. Okay. Well, as the big ball is expanding, the little ball is expanding, what's the little ball going to feel if it's sitting right on top of it?
I'm thinking nothing.
It's going to feel the pressure of this huge surface area expanding. While it's barely doing anything relative to the big one, it's going to get pushed up.
All right, I see what you mean. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's going to experience being pushed up just like being in the elevator. And that's truly what's happening with gravity. And McCutcheon nailed it right on the head in his book, The Final Theory. I hope everybody in the scientific domain reads that book.
Well, is it just happening now, or has it been happening all along?
It's been happening all along.
Gotcha.
And actually, the universe, this goes back into some of the Hindu or the... the Mahabharata writings about the various long cycles of the Earth, and I know other investigators have talked about that, including the Satya Yuga and the Kali Yuga cycles that map to the Great Year, which is our precession of the equinox period that's 25,920 years. So, anyway, did we go off topic there?
I'm sure we did, but it's okay. All right, let me ask you this then.
Okay.
You had a we got to get this in.
Okay.
You had a observed. Now, did you have a UFO sighting or did you have an actual encounter?
Well, you're referring to some of my significant influences that shaped my research on the Anunnaki. Well, I was about 14. I was in the front yard of my remote farm lifestyle that we lived in Arkansas on this little 7-acre farm. And I was out in the front yard kicking a ball up into our walnut tree because it must have been fall because all the leaves are gone. You could see the walnuts that were still stuck up in the tree. And I was just trying to knock them down. And walnuts were big business for poor folk, for Arkansas farm folk like us. You can get those things that would bring big dollars. So we'd put them in the driveway, let the cars run over them, and get all the husk off of them, and you'd take them down and sell them. And still to this day, everybody in that area, part of the world, they gather walnuts. So anyway, that said, it was real calm. It was about toward the end of the day, and there wasn't any wind. And I was kicking this ball, so my attention was up in the sky, and I looked at just across the road, this dirt road we lived on, and coming across this cattle field, not even 100 feet off the ground, coming right toward me, running parallel to our driveway, was this silver-shaped disc, wasn't making any sound, there weren't any lights on it, it wasn't spinning, and it wasn't creating any wind either, it was just floating about 5 to 6 miles an hour max. And it's just going right across over the top of this walnut tree, right next to across our garden, and over the top of our house. About the time it got adjacent to our house, I ran in the house, stunned at what I was seeing, and got my mom. And we went on the back of the porch and looked up at this thing, and just watched it go out over the back of our property and down into the woods, and just started terrain following, heading straight south, just real slow, not even a sound. It was like it didn't even know we were there, didn't care. And I was 14 in the middle of Arkansas. We didn't even have a TV, so I wasn't exposed to what these kind of aircraft were. I had dreams of flying when I was on the farm as a boy, but I had no idea what this was. I just flippantly said, "I wonder what that was, Mom. And maybe that was some sort of military aircraft they're using down at Fort Chaffee." That was down south of us near Little Rock. So, and that was about the extent of our conversation. And it took many years later till I realized the significance of what I just saw.
The reason that I ask you that is that these powerful entities, Anunnaki, whomever, they're not capable of transporting themselves by thought alone. They use vehicles of some sort. Is that the understanding as far as ancient record is concerned?
Well, here's what I know about that. And then there's a couple of instances, and it's a very good question. On the front of my book, there's a depiction of Enlil and Enki holding knobs on either side of this gate, and there's a being who's coming through it, through what looks like a portal. And this brings up the idea of what Saddam Hussein was fishing for in the city of Uruk. He was he knew that the high-level Anunnaki were visiting the Earth through what looked like, I don't know, like a portal. And it was some sort of chamber that only the very highest ranking being Anunnaki were allowed to use, including Anu. So that's why I put that on the front of my book. And this I give credit to William Henry for really bringing this to light, that it wasn't just some insignificant door he was walking through. And it turns out that the Anunnaki were very protective of a couple of places, usually where their mission control headquarters were. Started out at Nippur, moved north after the flood event, and they ended up establishing Jerusalem and Baalbek as landing ports and mission control centers. So that was a pretty significant find. And if you, just for the readers that will really want to check this out, Baalbek, Lebanon's design, if you look at the structure and the architecture of it, is exactly the same as the Temple Mount.
Unbelievable. This is fascinating stuff. It really is. All right. Well, all right, let me reset my brain and we'll come back for some more, okay? Our guest tonight is Gerald Clark, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And that is Gary Numan, the godfather of electronic music. Unbelievable stuff. Amazing how some of the music written so long ago has such a poignancy for our current condition. Well, it's been a quick, good Lord, it's been a quick 3.5 hours, but we have a little bit more to go. And I want to discuss with Gerald Clark the nature of the soul. What is that, according to his research? And are we about to be tricked into thinking that those who are clearly visiting us and have been visiting us over the many, many, many centuries and millennia, are they the real thing? Or are they deceivers? The most astounding things in this universe are the unseen and the unknown, but those things which we know exist. So hang on, there's a little bit more to go. This is Coast to Coast AM. Be right back. So Gerald, based on your all your research, have you come to any, maybe not conclusions, but opinions as to what is the nature of the soul?
Oh, well, I have my opinion like everyone else, and hopefully it's more representative of the area of your, well, the higher parts. And here's what I come up with, okay?
Yeah.
But first of all, we got to do a couple of term definitions. In my exposure to religious terms and physics terms, I would say that spirit and energy are the same thing. Would you agree?
I'm listening.
Okay. Well, let's make that assumption in our little argument.
Yeah, yeah. I'm prepared to roll with
that. So the nature of soul, we seem to allude to it as something that has personality, or that's the filter that sees life through, and it's somewhat permanent, and that it could be the energy that's involved in reincarnation if you buy into that.
All right.
Okay, well, energy is neither created nor destroyed. It only changes state. So there's a good possibility that if something is eternal, it's energy, and it only turns into matter, then turns back into energy, and turns back into matter, just like the equation E equals MC squared says it does. Okay?
I'm with you.
So going forward from that, I took that equation, thinking about how do you quantify human energy? Is it that E equals MC squared? Well, it works on rocks and planets and everything else. So if you apply it to us as humans and do a couple of substitutions of equations, you end up with an equation that's a function of weight and gravity and the wavelength and the frequency once you replace the speed of light. And we talked about that one earlier. So the speed of light equals the wavelength times frequency, and weight equals mass times gravity. And using those simple equations, you can replace and come up with what I did, which is what I call my equation 5A in the book. Okay, so actually it's equation 5. Now, since our chakras are quantized, where this energy, the soul, occupies matter, then it becomes a kind of a discrete summation, which is 1 to 7 of the wavelength and the frequency. Now, this is where it gets really interesting for me. E equals MC squared is kind of a bounded equation, and the maximum amount is based on just the mass, okay, and the speed of light is a constant. But in my equation, once I did these substitutions, all of a sudden, what if you have a being whose only first chakra is working and the other 6 aren't? Well, this equation takes that into account, and you see that now that one would come out pretty close to E equals MC squared. All of a sudden, if you talk about a being whose 7 chakras are now working, using a scientific principle called the superposition, all these waveforms that are operating at each of the chakras could be adding. And if the energies are coincident, meaning the phase of the signal is coincident, in correlation, in phase, then those energies could add, and they added as a squared term. So now all of a sudden this thing is squared twice, and now you're talking about something where E equals MC squared is not the same as E equals weight divided by gravity times the summation of the wavelength and the frequency from I equals 1 to 7 squared. And all of a sudden, you're violating his equation. And I'm not fully comfortable with that, but as far as I'm concerned, that equation represents what I believe to be the quantized energy of a human, the max energy, and I would say that If it's at its max, that is the energy of your soul. So that when you die and you have some energy that doesn't violate the law of conservation of energy, you're neither created, it's neither created nor destroyed. It materializes into matter, or it stays as energy as infinite intelligence, which I think it is.
Well, that would certainly, ghosts have been stories about ghosts for as long as people have been able to tell stories. So that would actually support the reality of a ghost. It's just it's still energy. It's still out there. It's just, as you say, it just changes forms. It's just released. It's neither created nor destroyed. It just exists.
I think we're saying exactly the same thing. And whether that ghost is a good entity or a bad entity. Now, think about the variability of the personalities of the humans on this planet. Everything from serial killers to, saints. We got the whole spectrum. Well, guess what? The Anunnaki did, too. So the idea of alien savers or deceivers or destroyers is something that's and I don't know if we finished with the soul yet, but I was going to jump onto that next one if you're ready.
That's okay. Yeah.
Are we ready to leave the nature of the soul? Do you get me?
Sure.
I'm kind of hitting it real hard, scientific, quantizing the energy of a being and saying, okay, this is the maximum you can obtain. Well, guess what? We can image this along the chakras and see these wavelengths changing as a function of the being's relationship to gravity in a big way. So the more integrated your body is with this line that runs vertical, orthogonal to the Earth, which turns out to be a pressure force, the more aligned up you are with that, the more this equation works. It looks like gravity is in the denominator of this equation. And I don't have to beat on it over the air because people can't see it. But when I sign custom books for people, this is the equation I put in there and tell them, hey, look at this and think about the frequency that you're on. So I think it's a very important equation, and I don't know that it's been published anywhere before. So I'm talking about it a lot because I think it's important to people. So putting that to rest for the nature of the soul, let's talk about and this is really, really contentious. I know people are writing books about the Vatican sponsoring alien saviors and they're the deceivers and all this. Well, think about this change in the Anunnaki Council, which is taking place. At the sign of Aquarius, and we're in the first degree of the age of Aquarius right now. So it's change time. So you're seeing that in the world, and definitely the forces of destruction have been released. And I want to talk about who those are, just real quick, to bring you up to speed on that. Then I'm going to get into this alien savior deceiver business.
Please do.
In the Revelations account, and I think it's Revelations 13. Paul or John is writing about. Who was the head of the essentially turns out to be the fallen angels, the same ones that were the Ajiji that mutinied and left and in the Lost Book of Enoch. And I don't want to get too far off on that. But anyway, it turns out that the idea of an alien savior or deceiver is quite interesting in that if it's true that Enlil was doing what he was doing to humans, and Enki was doing what he was doing, they were forces of light and dark that were going at each other. Okay, so now this council change has taken place. It looks like there's a 7-year of cleanup going on. In the Revelations account, Abaddon or Apollyon was referred to as the leader of the dark spirits. Okay, so you're like, oh, really? That name looks familiar. Well, Apollo was none other than Enlil's son. And his real name in Sumeria was Ninurta. Okay, so it turns out, also in that Revelation Council, it says if you go to Pergamum, guess what happened to Antipas there, one of our disciples at the Church of Pergamum. Well, he was burned to death, and where did this happen? At what they said was the seat of Satan, which was Pergamum, and who was there? Zeus was. That's where his temple is. Okay. So the Temple of Zeus was equated with the seat of Satan way back in the New Testament under the Gospel writers. Okay? So take that for what you believe it to be. But if you go back to Persia, you go, who was the creator and destroyer there? Well, it turns out it was the same ones. Creator was Enki, who was Ahura Mazda, who was Poseidon. And this destroyer was Angra Mayu, who was Enlil, who was Zeus. now all of a sudden, let's consider this. Anu goes, okay, council change time. Forces of destruction, you get your culling. When you're done, the forces of creation, you're in charge. That's what's happening. Enlil and his son are the forces of destruction. Okay, that's Enlil and Ninurta, or Poseidon, or I'm sorry, or Zeus and Apollo. So the idea of Apollo rising and asserting himself at the New World Order, this is a very, very important topic. So now all of a sudden you go, wow, okay, so there's this alien that's going to come here, and he's going to purport himself to be God, right? This is what's said in the Revelations account. Well,
yes.
Who is this? This is Zeus and Apollo. They're coming to destroy. So they're going to deceive as many people as they can into believing that they're the saviors. And it turns out that in Tom Horn's book, Exo Vaticana, he relates these alien saviors to cooperating with the Catholic Church. And so the idea of Zeus showing up as the Pope is what he's saying. And his son showing up as the commander of the forces, just like he was in Samaria, Ninurta, taking command of the most powerful nation on the planet to bring about this new world order, and that's the United States. So people have been on the lookout for Apollo and Zeus to be asserting themselves.
All right.
And guess what? They are. They certainly are. So,
Gerald, we have almost exactly 8 minutes, and I want to cover a couple of things with you.
Okay.
One of them is I know this is jumping around a little bit. This is
okay.
They won't let us go 5 hours. That's not going to happen otherwise. Believe me, I try and talk you into it. Tell us about structural integration.
Okay. Well, the curious thing about structural integration, and this is a form of manipulative body work that was invented by Ida Rolf in the 60s, actually earlier in the 50s, but it became popular in the 60s. What does it do? The application of this particular method that she purports is designed to change the connective tissue body of a human.
I went through that Rolfing before myself, yeah.
Did you? Well, way back when she was doing it, they used to call them, some of them, not all of them, samurai Rolfers, because they were really kind of brutal and using rocks and sticks and, you know, whatever they could do to get fascia to change. And they were learning. They were trying to figure this out. Well, they weren't interested in so much in a client-practitioner relationship that was mutually beneficial. They were trying to get change and figure it out. So this work got the reputation of being a painful massage and blah, 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 and it was really suppressed significantly. What's the potential of it? Within a 5-week period, 2 times a week, through her process of what's called a 10 series in structural integration. This is an international organization, by the way, but the two schools that do it are based in Boulder. One's called the Guild for Structural Integration. The other one's called the Rolf Institute. I just happened to go through the Guild for Structural Integration when I was trained. That said, through this process, within a 5-week period, for most normal people, the result is that the connective tissue can be loosened through this process. And because of that, the body will more easily relate to these lines and planes that need to happen in the body to line up in the gravity field. Why does that matter? Well, because of the equation that I put in my book, you'll see that the extent to which your energy is related to the gravity field is significant. It's probably one of the largest controlling factors. So this woman, Ida Rolf, stumbled upon this. So mixing structural integration with movement repatterning is what they recommend. So this changing and softening of the connective tissue simultaneously with moving through a full range of motion like Tai Chi or yoga causes very, very significant changes to human structure, such that old patterns can start coming out and gravity starts leading the being that seems to be a primitive intelligence that we have on how to line up with the gravity field once we get awoken to it. And listen, I'll tell you, from my experience of doing this work for, I don't know, going on 10 years now, and people I know, that unless a being gets this kind of work and interrupts all the patterns that have happened to their connective tissue from the time they learned to walk, that their probability of lining up the gravity field is going to be real hard. And the older you are and the more damage you've done, the harder it is. So get this work early, as early as possible.
Well, they'll take photographs week by week, and you will see the difference.
I do all the photographing with a plumb bob, the grid chart, all my clients. I wrote to my own software for seeing before after, and I've been doing this for years. And in addition to seeing clients like that, I was telling you, I was taking resonant field imaging pictures and polychromatic interference photography to look at the structural changes in their body and correlate that with this equation that I'm talking about for human energy. They're directly correlated. If you line your antenna up, I'm just going to say it straight up like an Arkansas boy, with the gravity field, it'll change your energy like you can't even imagine. Permanently. And
so
it won't stop.
Well,
you went through it. I could tell by looking at your picture. You've had your, what we call the superficial fascia, has been interrupted. It's been changed. And you can see that visually for people who have had structure work.
Yeah, I think you're right about this. And I got to tell you, it was not pleasant at times. Pretty rough.
How long ago did you do it?
20 years. And yeah. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was like, wow, imagine your legs spinning. Okay. It does seem to help a little bit, but oh my gosh, that hurts just to just turn it off. And yeah. But I'll tell you, the results are undeniable. They really are.
Yeah, well, actually, they've learned how to do it now in the modern way of implementing this, where there's hardly any pain. You ride the client's sensitivity thresholds where they're fully with you and not tightened up or resisting what you're doing. They're fully working with you, and you're not working on them. So a lot of the philosophy has changed about how to change fascia, and it's gotten so evolved that even the Western medicine people are holding annual fascia conferences to figure out what these crazy structural integrator Rolfers, Rolfing is a term that they use at the Rolf Institute. Structural integration seems to be the international term that's being used for it, and that's the one that Ida Rolf preferred, just so you know. And there's all this political jousting of it. Who really cares? The fact is, we know how to change connective tissue through pressure, tension, temperature, and frequency. And it has profound results for humans. And you start this process, and they start relating to gravity. And guess what? It just goes on for the rest of their life because gravity is then the therapist. Structural integrators are just the facilitators. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And I've really been focused on bringing that work to special needs children like my kid because that primitive intelligence even exists in them in order to know how to stack their blocks up into the gravity field so that it's supporting them and not pushing them down. Beating them up, giving them kyphotic humps all on their back and all the things that you see that happens to humans because they just don't know.
Let me give you 1 minute because we've got two. And how should people prepare for what's to come?
Well, I think, first of all, recognizing that signing up to dogmatic beliefs where there's an us, them, polarization needs to stop. People need to realize that we're all, in this together. And the reality is we were all created to live a better existence than what we've been put through. And I think if we could just hang on and group together and not destroy ourselves, I think we're about to see a golden age occur. Hopefully before the 7-year quote-unquote tribulation is up. It could happen sooner if we decided to be. Throw the bums out. Right? Don't let
yes.
them forget this.
There was they're trying. There were massive demonstrations up in D.C. Saturday.
Well, good news is that creation and destruction happen at the same time. So, yes, the dark forces are getting their culling, but the light forces are being unleashed, too. And if you really watch, you'll see them both at play. And so from that standpoint, yes, it's going to be ugly, but the end result is I think we're going to end up with a structure in relation to our true creators that are going to teach us how to live the right way, the way they did in Atlantis. And I put a quote in there from Critias and Plato that talked about the character attributes of the people they had on Atlantis. And I think that's truly what we want to aspire to be.
Gerald Clark, it has been an absolute pleasure to sit through a really short 4-hour show, but I'll stay in touch with you. You stay in touch with me and, we'll meet up again on the electromagnetic wave in the near future again, okay? Because everything we can think of is possible on some level in this reality. Many things are visited upon us. Some are a little bit rough. Some are quite pleasant. But for me, there are simply too many extras, from a bluebird and a strawberry to the sensation that's all kinds of good.